The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And we've been on a hot streak of late, some really good interviews in the last few weeks. So I'd like to thank my unnamed interviewee who came in to talk about her time in the zones of transition, the FARC camps, to talk about the reincorporation. Still the most popular episode of all time on the Columbia Calling podcast. And also, it's a time to say thank you to a couple of other people who have been very instrumental in promoting and, of course, having appeared on the show. That's Rob Carl, the assistant professor of history at University of Princeton, for his book on Forgotten Peace. And, of course, Dr. Abby Steele, up there at the University of Amsterdam. That's Democracy and Displacement in Colombia. And why am I bringing those guys up? Well, because today, episode 255, we have another academic in the room here, in the hot seat, and he's Colombian, but he is teaching at Western Washington University. That's Washington State, so West Coast stuff. Dr. Ricardo Lopez, who's originally from Bogota, the Doctor of History, and he's done some really fascinating ethnographic research to publish a book. It's out in English at the moment. It's called The Makers of Democracy, A Transnational History of the Middle Classes in Colombia. So let me take this moment to say thank you for coming and welcome on Columbia Calling.
No, thank you very much, Richard. I'm very happy to be here.
It's a real pleasure. You know, I've had obviously, you know, Americans and Europeans on plugging their books, but a Colombian academic who's here, who's back visiting Bogota just for a few days, it's a real pleasure. So just tell us a little bit of about this book. Let's start with the book, because that's really why we're here. I'm fascinated by the idea of the middle class in Colombia. Where did your ideas come from then?
Well, the very interest on the formation of the middle classes in Latin America actually come from, some personal reasons, but on the other hand, also, you know, some historiographical ones. For the latter, I'd say that, both in Latin America and the United States, you know, those historiographies have been obsessed with studying, they say, you know, class relationship from, you know, the either from the elites or from, you know, the subaltern classes. Mm-hmm. So, which actually speaks of a middle class interest to understand, you know, the other. But in this particular case, I started, you know, thinking about, well, you know, what is the role of, you know, the middle classes, in particular with this idea that, you know, it's been, you know, there for a while since, you know, the very least, I would say, you know, 1950s, and the association between, you know, democratization and the growth of, you know, a middle class, which perhaps, you know, later in the show we can discuss, which is now, again, you know, a very important discourse, the association between middle classes and consolidation of, you know, democracy. That's so then, you know, historiographical slash, you know, political interest, mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, why does actually, you know, the middle class know that all of us talk about, you know, the middle classes as a manifestation of, you know, democracy. Then the other part is more of a, you know, let's say, you know, personal interest. I, of course, have to confess my belonging to a middle class, right? And I started, you know, thinking about, you know, what that actually, you know, means to be, you know, part of a middle class from a historical perspective. And here I have to actually say, you know, some discussions back my undergrad, you know, years at the Nacional, and the discourse about, you know, the middle classes were actually actually, you know, forbidden to be called part of, you know, the middle classes or the language of the moment, which is coming from the left, you know, be part of, you know, the petit bourgeoisie, yeah, was almost
an insult.
That would actually be, you know, the perfect, you know, word, right? Uh-huh. So, man, I remember a conversation with a, you know, really good friend now, and he was, you know, told me in Spanish, se te salió la clase media. And so something like, you know, could actually be translated like, you know, you make evident, you know, your middle classness. And since then I started, you know, thinking about, well, you know, what do we mean when we actually say, well, you are, you know, part of the middle classes, you belong to the middle classes, and then, you know, associate that with, you know, a larger historical question about democracy. In other words, for me, a story of or a history of the middle classes is a way to talk about what I consider universal questions about democracy, both for Colombia and Latin America, but also in relationship to, you know, Europe and the United States. That's the transnational part of, you know, the transnational element in the argument of the book.
It's actually fascinating. And of course, if we think about this, I mean, we think about, let's say, the settlement by the Europeans, first the Spanish and then the other Europeans into Latin America. We're not thinking, you know, there's of course no middle class at that point. Mm-hmm. You're talking about, I guess, you've got your indentured labor almost, and yeah, then you've got your elites, yeah, coming over, mm-hmm, or your sort of, let's say, the guys who are elite but who are the losing part of the family because they have, yeah, to go to the new world. This issue of middle class then has completely evolved over, mm-hmm, over the decades. Mm-hmm. I mean, what we would think of middle class in 1950s Chapinero or Teusaquillo, mm-hmm, is very different to what we would think of today as middle class. And mm-hmm, so when you talk about that, maybe you could give us a bit of a background into the beginnings of a middle class, mm-hmm, in Colombia, especially when it comes to the migrations, yes, international migrations.
I would locate, you know, the formation of a middle class or middle classes as a social reality, you know, late 19th century, and then a certain consolidation of a particular formation of the middle class associated with, you know, white collar workers. Mm-hmm. The late 19th century, we're talking about, you know, artesanos, right? You know, this, that, you know, middle, you know, class, mm, or group, or social sector, that then, you know, with the process of, you know, urbanization, the growth of the service sector, right? You see office work, mm, as being associated with and in distinction to factory labor.
Yes.
So those associations that, you know, created an idea of middle classness that then white-collar workers themselves are going to start, you know, defining as part of their own, you know, identity. So historically speaking, I would, you know, locate this as a 20th century, you know, reality, formation of, you know, the middle class. Now, what is interesting is that, you know, late in the second half of, you know, the 20th century, you see the intensification of the service sector, what, you know, sometimes anthropologists, you know, call immaterial labor, which is a funny concept, but we can actually talk about that, you know, later. But then that association of, you know, labor for me is key, because we sometimes think of the middle classes only as those who consume and do not labor. We think of the working classes as those who labor and not necessarily, you know, consume. Mm-hmm. And I want to actually, you know, see that, you know, the formation of the middle classes is also a question of, you know, labor. So then, you know, during the second half of the 20th century, you see, you know, the professionalization, which means that the possibility to have access to, you know, higher education is now associated with a formation of the middle class. Yes. Access to higher education is not necessarily new in the 1950s and 1960s. The association between access to education with middle class is a reality of the 1950s. So let's take the example of, you know, architects. For the first half of the, you know, 20th century, I would argue, is an quote-unquote elite, you know, a reality. Not only because not too many people would actually have access to or being able to become a architect,
yeah,
but because the association with professionalization or with being professional was a feature of being elite. In the second half of the 20th century, that you could actually say, well, it gets popularized, but popularized in the sense of now being a professional is a central aspect of being a middle class. So as you can tell, for me, you know, the question of the middle class formation has a lot to do with labor. So expansion of the service sector, the expansion of industrialization with the, you know, small business owners, and professionalization of, you know, society, more broadly speaking. But that's, for me, you know, this is part of the book, you know, the second half of, you know, this 20th century, and specifically 1950s through 1980s.
Wow. So we're talking, you know, that boom, let's say, when Colombia was being really exploited for its good, let's say, for natural materials during the Second World War. Yeah. So while the rest of the world was dipping, but Colombia was selling, and so there was the building boom, the 1940s, 1950s, it continued, the need for raw materials, and that's when we saw, I mean, we can still see today so much of that 1950s architecture. Mm-hmm. That's what you're saying is the, sort of, let's say, the conception of a strong middle class.
Yes, it's
interesting, because that's when you'd see then these barriers, which you would label as middle class barriers, maybe today they're not
because they got popularized, quote unquote, right? Yes. So that's, you know, and this is really interesting because it's of course an appropriation from popular, you know, classes of those spaces that were imagined as middle classes, right? But this is also, you know, then you see a structural condition that allowed the formation of, you know, these, you know, sectors, but there was also, you know, state policies to create those conditions to, foster middle class identity. So now we actually see the expansion of the state, for example, with development programs of late 1950s, 1960s. Those development programs are not necessarily new, right? There are some development programs happening in the first half of the 20th century. And in fact, Colombia played a fundamental role as, quote unquote, laboratory for, you know, modernity. Mm-hmm. But during the second half of the, you know, 20th century, after World War II, for new, quote unquote, you know, political fears are in the in the context, in transnational context, then you see the Alliance for Progress, perhaps one of the most important development programs in the 20th century. The main task was to create what they thought would actually, you know, create democracy. Uh-huh. Just a middle class would avoid us from, you know, us meaning, you know, Colombia and Latin America, from getting into the hands of, you know, communism, right? And of course, historians have actually, you know, said this, you know, before, and they have actually, you know, said, well, but you see, communism spread. So it was a failure. And my argument is, like, you know, but it's quite the opposite. It did create the conditions for a middle class. But that middle class is going to actually radicalize and end up being, you know, the supporters of quote unquote communism. So that's the, you know, part of the, you know, the contradictions here. But that state policy as part of the Frente National Front. They're going to provide opportunities to work with the state. Mm-hmm. So we're thinking about the creation of, you know, different professionals from sociology to anthropology to public policy. All of these, you know, professionals, like the expansion of, you know, small business owners. You know, here we're talking about, you know, a copy, for example. And then, you know, the expansion of employees of white collar, you know, work, service work. Yes. You are going to see, you know, the expansion of major service companies. I'm thinking about, you know, Cafán, Avianca, Da Vivienda, late in the 1970s, places where, you know, people are going to work and they're going to start, you know, seeing themselves as middle class.
And if we think of an American version, I think of like something like Johnson & Johnson.
Yes.
That's what I've got in my mind. The gentleman putting on his, you know, nylon suit, white shirt, tie, sort of a bit of the feeling of Mad Men, you know, putting on that thing, the wife leaving the nice briefcase set to go to work. Yeah. I've got this image in my head. You said something really interesting, and I hadn't thought about the middle class being, you know, a method of preventing the spread of communism. Mm-hmm. So, of course, we have to ask, there must have been U.S. policy involved. Everyone must own a car, everyone must can travel, everyone can have education. Yeah. This is what you get when you live under, let's say, a beautiful capitalism.
Yeah.
Fascinating, and this is still dealt with in the book.
Yes, it is. It's a central part of, you know, what I usually call, you know, here, and if we have the time, then we have to, you know, talk about it, but it's, you know, it's a notion of, you know, capitalist democracy, otherwise known as, you know, liberal democracy, right? But there is, you know, an aspect that I want to call it, you know, capital democracy in order to understand what democracy means. But yeah, that's definitely, you know, the case. But there are, you know, two aspects here, you know, the both the National Front, which is very interesting because the National Front also emerged as a response to a peace process.
Yes.
In that particular context, they say middle-class society means to live in a peaceful society. You're going to see certain, you know, echoes currently, right, in our current moment, right? But in this particular, you know, context, what you see is that professionals, sociologists, anthropologists, so we're thinking about here Camilo Torres.
Yeah.
We're talking about Fals Borda, major thinkers who train professionals to avoid class conflict, which was associated with the spread or the possibility or the potential of, you know, spread of communism. So there is a specific, you know, training for this, you know, let's avoid this, right? Yeah. So before Camilo Torres became radicalized, he was very much part of the Alliance for Progress. ESAP, Escuela Superior de Administración Pública, you know, the public administration, you know, state school. Camilo Torres was, you know, one of the main, you know, directors of that political project. And he was convinced, he said, and there is a quote in the book that I'm sure I'm going to misquote, but that it is along the lines that, you know, neither the peasants, right, nor the working classes are going to be able to make democracy possible. The middle class would actually make this, you know, possible. Right? But then, you know, he's going to radicalize, you know, well, he's going to become, you know, radicalized. And what I tried to show in the book are the conditions that led to that radicalization of, you know, people like him and other sociologists, you know, professionals in general, that were supposed to prevent the spread of, you know, of communism, but as they were, you know, doing the work, right, going to the different, you know, towns across the country, they actually encounter the other and start actually having, you know, conflicts both with labor, you know, classes or subaltern classes and elite. It is in that particular process that they, you know, start, you know, radicalizing themselves, and they're going to end, you know, let's say the new left, and the new left, you know, some of them the new left, others in the old left, but most of them the new left, and they're going to actually challenge the National Front and the Alliance for Progress and, you know, imperial politics and everything. But this were, they were actually empowered by the same system that now they are actually criticizing.
Because it permits you. It gives you the space in which to move.
Yes,
you
know, absolutely.
That liberty in which to move. That's a very good point. A very good place to stop for a second here, take a pause, and come back and talk further about this topic, because it is actually fascinating, because I think it's one of these key issues that feathers in perfectly into a question about Colombian identity, because really part of what we're struggling with, in my opinion, right now, and I think we'll bring this conversation up to the present day, the student protests taking place and so on in the next segment of the show, is this: what is it to be Colombian? What is it to be Colombian from an urban area? What is it to be Colombian from a rural area? And I think that has a lot to do with what Dr. Ricardo Lopez is addressing here in his book and in the conversation with us here on Columbia Calling. Don't forget, we are talking to Dr. Ricardo Lopez of Western Washington University, that's out there on the West Coast, not far from Seattle. His book is out, The Makers of Democracy, A Transnational History of the Middle Classes in Colombia. It sounds to me like a riveting read. I can't wait to get my hands on it. But this is episode 255. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back talking further about this really, really interesting topic. So thank you for listening, and don't go away. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall here with Dr. Ricardo Lopez, the University of Western Washington, out there near Seattle on the West Coast, beautiful area, Pacific Northwest. We closed that last segment of the show. You know, we're talking about his book, The Makers of Democracy, A Transnational History of the Middle Classes in Colombia. I mean, why it appealed to me, of course, because I am dealing with issues that surround the middle classes for my thesis, talking about the area around the Estación de la Sabana, the central state train station in Bogota, a regeneration that is taking place, which is also a gentrification and pushing out traditional communities who have lived there. I mean, it was an area that had, let's say, upper class elites. Mm-hmm. You had generals, you had Is it Hans Borda who lived there? No, it's Leon de Grief who lived in this area and all the others. You'll find histories of upper class settlers, or let's say Europeans and so on, living in this area. It was still frowned upon by the original Creole elites, the Spanish elites in the Candelaria. They referred to it in a book as the back patio of the Candelaria. So, of course, the back patio where the Acantariado, the Rio San Jorge, or whatever, floods. But now, and then, of course, it became a middle-class area as things progressed. You've got your industrialization, and it's close. And then you've got a Jewish immigration, and they started building workers' houses, let's say working-class houses, to fill with many people for an industrial class. So I'm not even talking about middle class, industrial class, laborers. And that's when it all starts to change and you see it. But there are still people from the middle class, let's see, 1950s middle class.
Yeah.
Not a lot.
Yeah.
So that's why it jumped off the page at me when I saw your book. But I wanted to talk about a couple of things and then bring this conversation to the present day. And as I ended up, what does it mean to be middle class in the urban society, rural society, the stigmas, but I also find it fascinating that we're in a situation where I try and pinpoint, and you said the 1950s to 1980s, and I'm trying to pinpoint activities or construction or political ideas which then give birth to a more ample middle class. And I start thinking of Fernando Masuera, was it 5 times mayor or something? Three times mayor? And I start thinking about him and the sort of expansionist program. And more than a politician, he was a constructor. We're not far from it, the Masuera building on the 72 here. So I'm thinking of him as one of these. And also, and this is what, the left wing don't know what to do with when I say it, is Laureano Gomez. The expansion of transport and other things, which really would have appealed to the middle class, this sort of thing. But of course, we're looking at an ultra-right president, and of course he was. So, I don't know, if you were to put a label on politicians in Colombia who have been instrumental in this period, who would you say?
Okay, so this is a very, very interesting question. So let's say, 20th century Colombia. So I think it is, and it's very interesting, the very first political manifesto by a self-identified middle class political movement. And this is actually, makes a difference, right? So there is actually published in Pasto, right?
In Pasto?
In Pasto, yeah. Right. So that's okay. But then, then that actually moved to 1936, first political manifesto, and that is actually, the context of, Eduardo Santos. So, Eduardo Santos actually cultivated that particular idea. So that would actually, be, one president. Then, Alberto Lleras Camargos has played a fundamental role, in fact, to the point that he identified himself as part of a middle class. But again, that's actually, as a political concept, because we all know that Alberto Lleras Camargos is not, by any, structural definition of what middle class might mean, right? He cannot be part of the middle class, but that actually, speaks of the political concept and the legitimacy of the political concept. But, Alberto Lleras Camargos. Then, I tell a couple of stories in the book about, Guillermo León Valencia, who actually rejected a political project by against self-identified middle-class organization, who through lobbying the members of Congress and the president to create a state office for the consolidation of the middle class. So you have all of these people using all of these ideas from the National Front, but also from the Alliance for Progress to say, hey, you actually have to do something. But this guy, Guillermo León Valencia, said, no, you are too radical. We take one now. But okay, so Guillermo León Valencia, then you actually have the 1970s. Uh-huh. And in the 1970s, the three presidents we're talking about here is Pastrana, López Michelsen, and Turbay. Uh-huh. All of them made major investments in what they thought consolidating a middle class would actually be. Mm-hmm. But it's actually the early 1970s. This is the moment in which the middle classes have moved, part of the middle classes, to the ANAPO, Okay? And other, you know, part of the middle class radicalized itself and moved to, as I said earlier, the new left. So what you actually see in the 1970s is this effort to depoliticize, you know, the middle classes through the consolidation of what I consider the first experiment with neoliberal values. And in that particular context, then you have the UPAC. The UPAC, which is, you know, this is a very interesting, you know, concept there, and the transition from the possibility, they say, to have access to housing as an identification of the middle class coming from the state, you know, versus one, you know, coming from private, it's still with a, you know, state role in place, but, you know, coming from private, you know, hands, right? So those three, you know, presidents made up a major effort, but I would actually say with a new political organization, because there have been several political organizations, and what is very interesting that they didn't, you know, speak to each other. They didn't know that they existed, right? But the point is that, you know, here, you know, with Turbay Ayala, he said that he was not part of the elite, that he was not part of the, you know, the oligarchies, that he was very much part of this, you know, self-made man as part of, you know, the middle classes, and there was major support from, you know, the middle classes to the consolidation of, you know, Turbay, which achieved this form of depolitization to the point that they are going to actually, these middle class people are going to participate quite critically in the legitimation of the Estatuto de Seguridad. That is to say, like, you know, now we represent the middle class, so we can actually do whatever we want, because the middle class means democracy, and if we actually have the support of middle classes, then we can actually exercise the legitimate form of violence, right, torture and everything else, right, on those who, you know, challenge, you know, the system. So that's an aspect of, you know, middle class and democracy that perhaps we can actually talk more about.
That is really interesting indeed. So, but bringing this forward a bit then, how do these policies, you know, say the Pastrana, López Mikkelsen, Turbay Ayala policies, how have they helped informing the Colombia of today, where we see, you know, let's talk about it. We've got a pretty strong elite here. You know, the Colombia is technically pretty feudal. And we've got a large middle class. But what is it to be middle class? Because you've got upper middle class, middle class, lower middle class. And you know, there are different terms. What was it the government said recently? Anyone that earns around 4 million pesos a month is middle class.
Yeah, well, you know, that anybody, you know, making more than 4 million would actually be considered, quote unquote, rich.
Well, that's just over $1,000 right
now. Something like that, right? So that's just, you know, it is. But then that's the, you know, the political concept being used. And sometimes we get fixated with that, you know, trying to define what, you know, middle class mean from that, you know, a structural / political concept. But we also have to ask, what does this political concept, middle class, achieve in the legitimation of what we may consider, quote unquote, a democratic society? And that's when you actually see, you know, the problem. So my book, you know, finishes in 1982, and I do, but I have to say, I had to make a decision and finish at some point, because otherwise I wouldn't have been able to, you know, get the book done. But we see some certain connections between I don't want to call it, you know, a traditional middle class, because, you know, the concept that I use in the book is like, you know, all of these manifestations of middle class are quote unquote democratic. What we have to specify is what we mean by democracy in that particular, you know, in those particular contexts. So what you see here, and here I'm just basing all some of these comments on my ethnographic work with several self-identified, you know, middle class, is that what is at stake here is a neoliberal definition of democracy. Which I would actually say is a consolidation of with the current government, and then more alternative definitions of democracy, also predicated on a notion of middle class, but that have been silenced. And we actually see an example now with the student movement going on. One of the main points is not that, you know, other people in the middle class, they don't want education. It's the definition of, you know, education as individual achievement or education as a collective right. You're going to see that particular struggle, but both of them are associated with the notion of middle-class society. So it really depends on, you know, how we define, you know, democracy in the current moment. But the other part is, well, you know, here I have an argument about who has the right to rule in democracy. And my argument here in my book is that what we usually, you know, think of, you know, middle classes is the legitimacy of saying we have the right to rule. That is why both Santos and Uribe, they do talk a lot about the middle classes. That is why, you know, what's his name? Alvaro Uribe.
just a little bit.
I tend to forget, you know, those names. But anyway, so both of them do talk about the notion of middle class. They may disagree about, you know, the peace accord, but they both believe that a middle class society, what they refer to as middle class society, is the feature of Colombian society, what they usually refer as the post-conflict society. What do they mean by that? They mean privatization of life, right? It means the individualization of rights. That is to say that, you know, the rights are, you know, privileged. There is no distinction there. That it means, you know, the, what I usually refer to as the paramilitarization of, you know, society, meaning that the notion of justice is exercised at the individual level. And you can actually, you know, see all these examples on, you know, social media of, you know, making justice possible. It is the a notion of labor, which is predicated on a neoliberal idea of entrepreneurship, meaning you have no boss, you are your own boss. That is to say that, you know, you perpetuate your own exploitation. But in the name of not having a boss, then you perpetuate another, you know, form of exploitation. That is, I would say, you know, a neoliberal definition of, you know, democracy that is predicated on a very specific definition of, you know, of democracy. The one that actually won late, well, back in the 1970s and 1980s. It is a definition of democracy that, and here is, you know, this is an important part to mention, Carlos Castaño, he used
the paramilitary,
you know.
From those who don't know.
Yeah. He used to say, he said on several, you know, in his book, interviews and other sources, he did say that the paramilitary groups were, you know, the arm, the armed rebellion on behalf of the middle class, that they were not part of the elite. People have not paid attention to that, right? So he did know that that was the way to legitimize his political project. Of course, we know a lot about, you know, these paramilitary, you know, groups and everything, but I will invite people to think about the association of a middle class, quote unquote, democracy with the paramilitarization of, you know, society, so that we actually expand the understanding of what you usually refer to as, you know, Uribismo, and not seeing as a response to Uribe himself as an individual, but as part of a larger transnational project of neoliberalization of society. So that is the definition of democracy that now, you know, prevails over all the definition of democracy that are the ones that we actually see on the street, you know, being reclaimed by other groups.
I had not expected Carlos Castaño to be mentioned in this one, which gives us a whole different arena of things about which to think. A main leader of paramilitary groups, AUC, who's up in the US in jail. Yeah. I was just reading about him the other day. He's saying he's going to release all of his secrets. Yeah. He wants to be accepted into the Justicia Especial para la Paz, which would be quite amazing if he did release his secrets, because I think it would undo a lot of issues. But a larger transnational project. So basically, kind of like if we think of Chiquita brands paying the paramilitaries to protect their protecting inverted commas their lands, their privately owned lands and their territories up in Urawa is part of this greater transnational project. Carlos Castaño would be, then be a poster boy for private industry entrepreneurship. It's quite a, something to get my head around when I think of the barbarity of this man and his men, and of course the exploitation that took place. You deal with this in your book?
Well, I partially deal with this.
It's a whole other book.
Yeah, it is another book, and I actually been thinking about this. You know, the book ends with a discussions of the implications of some of my historical arguments. And just to put it, quite simply here, given, of course, like any other historical argument, it's response to, the present that you are, writing the argument from. And of course, I was writing the conclusion at the very moment of, the referendum, right? Yeah. And I was talking to some of the, about middle class people, including my family, I must say. So, and here is what is the argument I make at the end of the book is, well, the first one is that we need to call out middle classes in urban parts of Colombia to not just to understand the conflict, but how historically speaking have been implicated in the creation of a social order, right? Based on a hierarchy that have actually, produced, partially because there are, so many reasons why the political conflict, emerged. I wouldn't be, say, well, it was all about the middle class, no. But that what these middle class people, the idea, the definition of middle class democracy that I just described, were actively, made by certain people who benefited, right, in order to become, middle class, but that actually excluded other social groups, and that that exclusionary social order have played an important role to the consolidation of a conflict, a social conflict in Colombia. So I partially take issue with the argument by Sanchez, the historian, the from the Comisión de
Sanchez. I can't remember at the top of my head, but.
That argument that they say that the middle class are are not in relationship to what really is going on in rural parts of Colombia. I take an issue with that because you imagine that the urban middle classes are in a different reality, and what I argue they are not in a different reality. So I call out the middle classes to assume a historical responsibility. Of course, not a legal one. Legal ones are different question, but a historical responsibility to the consolidation of a political conflict in Colombia. To put it quite simply, we usually say, well, people did not vote; they prefer to stay on their, sofas watching TV and everything else. And they say, that was not necessarily the case. Middle class have been a political force that has consolidated a social order that did benefit them, not just elites, but them as middle class, and exclude other people, rural people that they consider backward, that they consider they had not the right to rule. So when you talk to some of these people, they would actually tell you, do you actually see what's going on in Bolivia with Evo Morales? And they associate Evo Morales with, the countryside, with the possibility to exercise, the right to rule in democracy because, according to them, he is not educated, right? So this is, then you actually see association between the countryside, the lack of education, backwardness. So when they see this, guerrilla members, this is exactly what they imagine. So that's, what I try to, call them out on that particular historical responsibility. The second aspect, which is a provocation. That's the last, I end up with a provocation. And the provocation is that we may have to, rethink democracy, or at least, rethink democracy otherwise, in which the association between middle class and, democracy is not necessarily there.
It's a very big question for Colombia, especially because what works for Colombia is not technically what works elsewhere. I'm not going to say that. I end up talking to people and they always say, oh, Colombia's so complicated. Well, actually, when you unravel things, it's not all that complicated, but we've made these differentiations, and we've made these chasms between these different areas. And I just want to bring it to you on this one. I'm surely you've been watching this as a Colombian, a Colombia watcher, and a historian, and everything, because it all comes into up to the fore. If we think about the referendum on the Peace Accord 2016, the presidential elections 2018, and then the referendum on corruption, as it was called, 2018, we are getting that younger middle class coming through and voting. There is a change, mm-hmm. and I'm seeing it. I don't know if it can bring about full change or extreme change, but I see a pressure being applied by these, let's say, I don't like calling them, these millennials, but they are middle class, they're bicycle riding, university educated, they go to co-working places, drink too much coffee, you know, that's that image. But I see them growing up, and I've said this before on this podcast, what we're seeing are these individuals, these men and women who have not lived through the worst eras of Colombia's conflict, who don't have it present in their, let's say, antagonism, mm-hmm. and are pushing for something else, usually. And I would say these are very, you know, very middle class, but they are creating a movement. Whether it's going to be successful enough or whether they become in their own gentrified form of stability and say, well, you know, let's just go with the norm. And even these last couple of weeks where there's been this move against
Sarmiento Angulo?
Sarmiento Angulo, Grupo Aval. I didn't want to be too revolutionary, but you see it. There's a rejection. I mean, he's still going to have $10 billion, but there's a rejection. And, you know, stocks do not prosper underneath public unrest. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, let's bring the big question to the end here. How do you see this middle class of which I speak in the future, and the future of this country politically in the immediate future? Let's not predict 20 years, but the immediate future under this presidency of Iván Duque.
Okay, this is a really interesting question. I would add, you know, an element that terms, you know, the social media, right?
Okay.
This is actually happening, you know, the social media. And there is a, you know, a whole discussion about whether the social media can actually, you know, plays a role in social change, probably understood. It is a very difficult, you know, question. I want to be optimistic. I really wanted to be optimistic. So there is indeed, I actually historicize that in the book. I don't know if I should actually call it, you know, radical, but let's say a more interesting version of democracy. And this is what I see in the current moment, right? With some parts of, you know, the middle classes, student movements, right? You know, a critique of, you know, corruption, another aspect that you just mentioned. So I do think that, you know, this is going to be an interesting part. And, you know, given what's been happening the last few days, I am hoping, and I emphasize, you know, that I am hoping that then this movement, young movement, can actually, you know, make a difference. Mm. I would be remiss if I said that, you know, I think this is going to, you know, change everything. I see some elements that are, you know, important. The redefinition, for example, for me is key. The redefinition of education is absolutely, you know, crucial. But in that redefinition of democracy, of education, we need to get away from the definition of democracy as competition. And this is the key part, right? Because we keep talking about education because all of us think education is a major part for us democratic society, quote unquote, to function. Mm-hmm. But we do not talk about what the definition of education is all about. So ser pilo paga, it is predicated of a neoliberalization of society. Mm-hmm. Competition, individualization of economic success. So what we see these students asking for is, you know, education as a right. Mm-hmm. That's a different definition of, you know, education, right? And I hope that we actually see a change there. With this, you know, current government, I see a contradiction that can be very productive. That is to say that, you know, given how much this government has been, you know, predicated on the definition of middle class, that can actually be used for a different understanding of what can actually, you know, be a middle class society. So, yeah, that's what I would actually have to, you know, say there.
Well, I think you're right on that one, that elements can be changed.
Yeah.
A whole overhaul of a system here won't happen. It won't happen overnight. It's too entrenched. But we're moving, as you say, and it's the social media side of things. Yeah. But of course, tweeting, retweeting, following does not put things into action. No. You know, that's the thing. Yeah. You know, we don't feel just because you tweeted about something is you're not affecting change. Yeah. So there's these issues.
It makes you feel good, though.
It makes you feel good. It's like, yeah, I supported that.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah.
That's my IP. But it's not the same. It's not the same as the students being out in the streets. It's not the same as, you know, closing your bank account, which some people are talking about. And that. But it's a really fascinating time. And I always say to people, I go through peaks and troughs here in Colombia, and these last couple of weeks have been troughs. But talking to you gives me a little bit of a peak.
I don't want to interrupt you, but there is, you know, a point that is what is going on what you usually refer, you know, as in the regions of the country. That's another part that gives me hope. People are doing a lot of, you know, things. So that's something that we actually have to, you know, keep in mind. And I think it is important that we think of, you know, peace more critically. I have to use this term, you know, the right. And, you know, the former president of this, you know, country, Santos, and Álvaro Uribe, they disagree on peace. And it has been, you know, the critique of peace has been monopolized by certain groups, right? The moment that you criticize peace, that you actually get, you know, categorized as, you know, part of that group. And that is a problem, right? But we cannot just give up on the idea that then, you know, peace is, you know, just the answer. I would actually argue, and this has been coming from what people do in all over the place, that peace is actually the question, not the answer. And if we actually, you know, switch things that way, then we can actually remain hopeful. Because then what is at stake is the redefinition of peace. Mm-hmm. Not peace as investment, economic investment, not peace as exploitation, but peace as, you know, solidarity, peace as equality, you know, peace as access to education. So this is what I actually, you know, see is happening with some of these, you know, groups that are trying to redefine what, you know, peace means. Mm-hmm. Because for some groups, peace means war. There is no distinction for some of those groups. So I think, you know, let's hope that that's gonna, you know, make a difference.
Leave this as a big question out there to the listeners. Of course, you can always get in touch with us and tell us what you think about Dr. Ricardo Lopez's comments here on Twitter. We're at Columbia Calling, Facebook, etc., and email if you've got something incredibly virulent to write. ColumbiaCalling@gmail.com. Dr. Ricardo Lopez is on Twitter and so on, so you can find him there. I'll post his links. Of course, check out his book if you're in the US or you're an academic and you're thinking, you know, you're doing your studies. The Makers of Democracy, A Transnational History of the Middle Classes in Colombia. It's out this year. So fascinating. I'm really interesting chat, and I do think that the middle class and this conversation is essential. About what it means. And so let me take this moment to say thank you so much for coming. I know you're only here for a week, and so I feel privileged to have had you here at least for an hour to talk about this. So thank you again.
Oh, thank you. And actually, you know, the privilege is all mine. And, you know, I really enjoyed, you know, the conversation. Thank you very much.
As I say, flattery will get you everywhere. But as I said, so we're closing off episode 255 of the Columbia Calling podcast. We'll be back next week. We're going to be talking about the Comisión de Verdad, the Truth Commission, that of course has been started this last week and runs in the almost impossible aim of finishing it within 3 years. So we'll be talking to an expert from George Washington University about this next week. So thank you again for listening. Let's hope that this hot streak continues. So bye-bye, and of course keep sharing this around the social media eagles. All right, thank you again. Bye-bye.